Okay, should I start? All right. Great. So, good morning from California, and thanks so much. I'm really honored to be invited and to join this celebration of Steve's work. I really wish I could have been there, but I'm grateful to Jean-Baptiste for squeezing me in virtually. And thanks to all of you for hanging around until a time that would not be in the middle of the night here. Cool. So maybe I'll start with a little story time. I was an undergrad at the University of Michigan. I started, I think, just the year after Steve left Michigan for MIT. But the fictionalism he pioneered remained very much in the air at Michigan, and my undergrad thesis ended up being a sort of defense of his view from the critiques of Jason Stanley. I remember reading Does Ontology Rest on a Mistake as an undergrad and just being kind of amazed that it was possible to do analytic philosophy and still write like that. Like, that was allowed. Writing this kind of the verve and the style Steve is famous for. The possibility proof of his writing is a kind of indictment of the discipline, in a way. Anyway, I remember how excited I was when I got the voicemail from MIT that I'd gotten into the grad program, and it was Steve himself calling, which kind of blew my undergrad mind. Steve ended up one of my advisors, and this was really one of my great fortunes in philosophy, and his example has always been an inspiration to me. So thanks a lot, Steve, for that. So like I said, I thought I was going to talk about fictionalism, but I got sucked into this amazing recent paper of Steve's on non-existence and negative existential. So I want to just pick up on that thread instead. So let me just get into it. I have a handout. It probably didn't arrive in time to print. I'll put it in this chat for those of you joining on Zoom, and I will share it and just go through it. Okay, just one sec.
We do have the handout on paper.
Amazing. All right, that's great. Okay, super. That'll make things easier. But I'll share my screen anyway. Okay. Right, so most of you, I imagine everyone will know the, textbook problem for negative existentials present for a million style view of names. I'm picking up on this paper, by the way, of Steve's The Bandersnatches of Dubuque, which is itself starts out anyway as a commentary on Kripke, negative existentials. So, the problem, take sentences like one and two, Holmes doesn't exist, Vulcan doesn't exist. How could those be true, and what are they about? Especially if you're a million, it looks like there's some kind of hole in the meaning of the name of the some kind of hole in the meanings of these sentences. Kripke has a lot to say about the role of empty names, but when it comes to this particular kind of construction, as Steve discusses, it's not entirely clear what Kripke's view is. He says something like, he says he wished he knew what to say, and he says that maybe no propositions are expressed here really at all, but somehow you're kind of getting at the idea that a certain form of proposition isn't there. Another kind of view you could have is Stonelockers, and I'm just mentioning this because Steve picks up on it in a certain way. So the Stonelocker response to these kinds of cases, I take it, is to say that these express true propositions and there isn't some big semantic problem getting that result. Holmes doesn't refer, so its referent isn't in the extension of exists at any world. So it's necessarily true that Holmes doesn't exist. One is kind of tantamount to nothing there is Holmes. Denying existence, it's important to see, isn't the same as ascribing a property of non-existence. It's not that we're saying of Holmes in some loaded sense that he has the property of not existing. We're just denying he exists. And so things like one and two, we can see how they're not just true, but necessarily true. Yablo, well, my handout says Yablo, but it's weird to say Yablo. I'm going to say Steve. So Steve says, good. You know, it's right that one is, in a sense, a claim about everything. That begins to give you a handle on why we find Holmes exists to be false rather than kind of defective. It's partly mischaracterizing us understood, you know, we existence. But there is this lingering problem about the difference in cognitive significance between one and two. And here's how Steve puts it. To learn that Holmes doesn't exist gives us one sort of information about everything. To learn that Vulcan doesn't exist tells us something quite different. Holmes exists, thus apparently misdescribes everything in one way. Vulcan exists, misdescribes it in another. So what I think the really interesting thing Steve's getting at here is that there seem to be distinct bodies of non-trivial knowledge frameable with the help of these two empty names. So, and Steve brings this out in these parts of the paper, he says. You might think it's a priori, for instance, that Holmes, if he exists, is not a black and white dog born in 2005. I appear to know that if Holmes exists, he lived in the 19th century, and hence he isn't one of us, since none of us were alive back then. I appear to know that if Vulcan exists, then there are planets closer to the sun than Mercury. So this brings Steve to this general idea, the idea of an indicative implication. Say N exists indicatively implies Q relative to a knowledge state I, just in case I supports if N exists, then Q. And then, you know, here's an idea. One learns N does not exist by learning that some such indicative implication is false. So the cognitive cache value of N doesn't exist lies in its indicative implications. These will be different for distinct empty names. So the thought is something like Vulcan doesn't exist conveys that everything has the property of being an X, such that if Vulcan exists, it isn't Vulcan. Something like that. Okay, so that's a sort of super fast summary of some of what happens in this very rich paper. So I just want to kind of pick up on a thread that's coming up here. At one point, Steve writes, you know, the role of the indicative conditional is important in the discussion, so he asks himself, as it were, the question, but what is your semantics of for indicative conditionals? And he says, I'm tired of ducking this question. And then musters the strength to duck it one last time. And but he, rightly so, as I'll go over. I kind of want to touch on some of that issue. This seems like the right sort of thing to leave to a former grad student, this kind of detail. So let me try to help a little bit. What I want to focus on is this is a point that Steve's story leans in a very important part on states of what I'll call iffy knowledge, basically states described via knowledge descriptions embedding indicative conditionals. So, you know, things of the form A knows that if P, then Q. And I just want to ask in this talk how these descriptions work. What do they say? And I think it's actually, they're kind of puzzling and interesting. So Steve's discussion focuses attention in particular on cases where A knows that not P, and A knows that if P, then Q. For instance, Steve knows that Holmes doesn't exist, but he knows that if Holmes does exist, he's not one of us, or he's a detective, or whatever. For me, these just kind of already raise an interesting question, which is like, what? So, you know, if A's knowledge state rules out P, what could we mean by A knows that if P, then Q? If the embedded if is epistemic and not counterfactual, right? I mean, with the indicative, we're used to thinking that's supposed to reach for live antecedent possibilities. But we just said there are no, you know, if we know that Holmes doesn't exist, there aren't any such possibilities. So, and yet I agree with Steve, these constructions sound okay. So what's going on? So I'll make a suggestion about that. But first, I want to consider some other puzzles involving these descriptions, and These will nudge in the sort of direction that Steve favors in this paper, which is broadly Ramsian picture of how we think about indicative conditionals. So here are some sort of additional puzzles to think about in connection with these iffy knowledge statements. Okay, I'm on 2.1. Here's a cafe case. So imagine this, my two favorite cafes are across the street from one another. I want to take you to one of them, but don't care which, so I pick one at random and off we go. Sitting in the cafe, I can say 3, but not 4. This is just reminding you of the counterfactual indicative distinction. If we weren't at this cafe, we'd be at the one across the street. Maybe that's right, but it would be super weird to say, if we're not at this cafe, we're at the one across the street. We're clearly at the cafe we're at. Okay, now, suppose Bill glances into our cafe but fails to spot us. He then goes looking for us in the cafe across the street. I might explain to you what's happening as follows. I told him we'd be in this cafe or that one, so Bill knows that we're either at this cafe or the one across the street. I also could have said, Bill knows that if we're not at this cafe, we're at the one across the street. You know, when I try this on ordinary speakers, they don't flinch at all. But this is puzzling for at least two reasons, maybe more, but at least the following two reasons. First, it looks on the face of it like a failure of entailment. Bill, we just said 6, but I already pointed out it would be really weird to say the conditional on its own. I think it looks very plausible that one can accept that Bill knows that if we're not at this cafe, we're at the one across the street, without being under any rational pressure to accept that if we're not at this cafe, we're at the one across the street. I really don't know what it would be to accept that conditional. So on the face of it, it looks like a failure of entailment. There's also a failure, relatedly, of factivity, right? So 6 doesn't seem to presuppose the conditional it embeds any more than it entails it. And again, it's just hard to see what it would be to take that conditional for granted in that context. Okay, there's the first case of iffy knowledge to puzzle about. Here's another case to change it up. The marbles case. So suppose we randomly put a marble under one of 3 cups, A, B, or C. It ends up under cup A. We make Jane guess where it is, telling her it's under one of the cups. She guesses C. We say, nope, it's not under C. It's either under A or B. Guess again. We can say, Jane knows if it's not under A, it's under B. But we, I take it, wouldn't be disposed to say, if it's not under A, it's under B. I mean, imagine, you're just like looking at the marble, like cup A is open and you're just looking at the marble right under it. It's just super weird to affirm 8. But it might be fine to say something like 9, it's under A or B. So there's another case to think about. And here's one more. This is connecting the phenomena to Sly Pete style cases, if you know those from Gibbard. So suppose we have Carl play this game too in isolation from Jane. The marble is still under A. We make Carl guess. He picks B. And we say, nope, it's not under B. It's under either A or C. Guess again. I think we can say, just like for the same reason we can say 7, we can say 10. Carl knows that if it's not under A, it's under C. And to my surprise, when I first started thinking about this a couple of years ago, speakers think this is fine. It's fine to say this all in one breath. Jane knows that if it's not under A, it's under B. And Carl knows that if it's not under A, it's under C. I should say, emphasize that it took me some time to... These phenomena are really quite unexpected if you're used to thinking of knows as factive and used to modeling these pieces of language in certain ways. It really took me a minute to be convinced that ordinary people had these judgments, as they just seem to be a little unexpected. But this is what I find when I ask people. So, and I think at the end of the day that we can make a lot of sense of these intuitions, but we'll get there eventually. So, so that's a third kind of case. So, what do these cases have in common with what Steve's talking about? Well, like Steve, I'm talking here in these three kinds of cases about situations where it's known or assumed that P is false, and yet someone is said to know if P then Q. These examples key into the following kinds of points. First, that we can accept that A knows that if P then Q without accepting if P then Q. Second, we can accept that A knows that if P then Q and also accept that B knows that if P then not Q. On the face of it, puzzling if you think knowledge would entail its complements and conditional non-contradiction is true, that looks like very puzzling, but maybe none of those are right. And then the last point these cases bring out is that it can be true that A knows that B knows that if P then Q, even when it would be wrong to say that A knows that if P then Q. I mean, think of yourself as the knower, as A, as it were, in these cases. You might know that, for instance, you know that Jane knows that if it's not under A, it's under B, but it's not that you know that if it's under A, it's under B. So hopefully this seems pretty puzzling on the face of it. These kinds of data, I think, are really not that easy to understand on the hypothesis that iffy knowledge descriptions relate their subjects to conditional propositions. I previously had a whole section of the handout arguing for that, but I don't think I have enough time to go through that, but I'd be happy to discuss the challenges there. Hopefully, kind of on the face of it, it seems sort of clear that it's going to be difficult to think of conditionals picking out a proposition, because we, you know, it would just beg the question, would raise the question like, well, if Jane knows that if it's not under A, it's under B, is just relating Jane to some conditional proposition, why isn't that conditional proposition expressible in the matrix context with that same construction? Or like, well, you know, if your knowledge related to the proposition, then unless we've something radical has happened, that proposition's got to be true. Why can't we express it at the matrix context? Or if we can, you know, what do we have to do that? A bunch of problems are asked. But let me cut to what I think is a better approach to thinking about what's happening here, and trying to capture what looks like a sort of relativity in this iffy knowledge. And it starts right from basically the Ramsian idea of how we think about indicative conditionals. There's some kind of like rule that you have to mention Ramsey in any paper on indicative conditionals, so I'm just following the rule here. So. So the thought is, here's a candidate procedure. Now, what I want to do is really, in this talk, I'm not going to try to give a compositional semantics of iffy knowledge descriptions, but I do want at least to try to arrive at a sense of the truth conditions of the descriptions. So en route to that, let's think about one kind of way you could think about what it would take for 10 to be true, just to pick one of these descriptions as an example. Carl knows that if it's not under A, it's under C. When is that true? Maybe it's something like this. Take Carl's epistemic state, think of that as a set of worlds, temporarily add to it the information that the marble's not under A, then ask, does the resulting state of information non-vacuously entail that it's under C? If so, then 10 is true. That's one idea. So. That kind of idea involves thinking that we're sort of considering Carl's epistemic state as temporarily updated by the antecedent. So that's the Ramsian kind of sort of dynamic information-sensitive kind of idea. And it's interesting to note, you know, that in epistemic state, updated with a antecedent, the resulting information state itself is not a knowledge state, which might give us a clue as to why these ascriptions are such as to not always entail the conditional snippet. Okay, so if we have this picture, I think it suggests something like what I call here the basic Ramsey truth condition for iffy knowledge, which is 10 is true just in case there are worlds where the marble is not under A among Carl's epistemic alternatives, and all of these are worlds where it's under C. Okay, pretty basic picture. I like the simplicity of this. And we can pair this kind of basic truth condition with a matching picture of what it is to accept an indicative conditional in conversation. Just apply the same sort of story about what it is for an epistemic state to incorporate the indicative conditional to the conversational context, right? So an indicative conditional, we could try saying, is accepted or presupposed relative to a context set, a set of worlds compatible with what's presupposed, just in case there are open antecedent worlds in the context set, and all of these are worlds where the consequent is true. So just that already predicts the entailment failures we've noted, at least the puzzle cases I brought out. So for instance, right, you can take for granted Carl knows that if it's not under A, it's under C in conversation, without also being forced somehow to take for granted the conditional it embeds. You know, the conditional is basically expressing a kind of property of information states. You're saying Carl's knowledge state has the property, but Carl's knowledge state having that property doesn't force the context that to have the property too. While there's more to say, this looks like a path towards making sense of the seeming relativity of iffy knowledge brought out by these examples. Okay, so we're not out of the woods yet, though. There is a problem that comes up here, and it is relevant to the stuff that Steve's talking about. So the kind of basic story I just described, if you kind of followed the details, sort of, you might have noticed that I kind of kept insisting that if a state of information, like a state of knowledge or a context set, can be described as accepting an indicative conditional if phi then psi, then it's got to leave phi worlds open. So you might call that antecedent compatibility. And that idea is motivated by the idea that we don't want not phi to entail if phi then psi, okay? As would be the case, for instance, on like a material conditional analysis, or, you know, some versions of the modal semantics would license that. But I take it we don't want that. Among other things, it would trivialize the sort of iffy knowledge Steve is relying on to distinguish the cognitive significance of one and two. So, you know, given that Steve knows that Holmes doesn't exist, we don't want to get even close to deriving that Steve knows that if Holmes exists, Q for any Q, like if Holmes exists, there are planets closer to the sun than Mercury. No, that's what Steve knows if Vulcan exists, not if Holmes exists, right? There's a difference. And if simply knowing Holmes doesn't exist is enough to put you in position to trivially derive all the indicative conditionals you please, starting with if Holmes exists, then you'll never get the interesting, robust iffy knowledge that Steve is talking about. So we don't want triviality one. I think there's just other reasons we don't want it. I've motivated many people in the literature to avoid it. The kind of reason it's more often avoided in the literature is the thought that, at least especially in the papers that I've written in this area, the motivation for rejecting triviality one is tied up with epistemic possibility. So the idea is indicative conditional antecedents, and indicative conditionals require their antecedents to be epistemically open, which the most straightforward way to model that would be to say, this thesis I'm calling mighty indicatives is true. If you have it that if phi then psi, then it might be that phi. Okay. Maybe you would encode that as a presupposition of the conditional and get it that way. That's a pretty common thing to do. Here's a bunch of papers that talk about this kind of thing. So if you think that's right, then you're going to end up with this second thing I'm calling triviality two, that if you have not P and you have if P then Q, then those together are incompatible. Why are they incompatible? Well, if you have mighty indicatives, then if P then Q entails it might be that P. But then is not P compatible with might be that P? No, or so I've claimed. Right. So then suppose you, and of course that's a familiar idea if going back in the dynamic tradition too. Lots of people, I think, are on board with not wanting those things to be cotenable. So so if you don't want epistemic contradictions, then it looks like you're going to be led to this second kind of triviality, because the indicative conditional will force it to be the case that the antecedent might be true. Okay, and that's where I think we get into a problem, or I realize this gets into a problem thanks to a paper by Ciardelli. So he, I think, has finally convinced me that this thesis I'm calling mighty indicatives is not correct. And you might, he talks about cases like, I give relatively well-known cases like this Shakespeare case. I've given it as a dialogue form to try to pump intuition. So imagine a dialogue like this. Shakespeare wrote Hamlet, says A, and then B says, agreed. But if he didn't, did someone else? And A might say, yeah, obviously. But I'm sure it was Shakespeare. So on the face of it, if that dialogue sounds okay, it seems like we have it in the common ground here that Shakespeare did write Hamlet. No one's disputing it. But it also seems to be agreed that if he didn't, someone else did. I also don't think, however, despite those two things being the case, I don't think it's common ground that it might be someone else who wrote it. That would threaten it being true according to the context that Shakespeare didn't write Hamlet Shakespeare wrote Hamlet and he might not have, which doesn't sound coherent. So I think the way to solve this is to say, no, the indicative conditional doesn't actually, after all, entail that its antecedent is epistemically possible in the sense that we express with the word might or possible. So that's sort of one example to get you skeptical of mighty indicatives. Ciardelli doesn't directly talk about knowledge description, but the failure of mighty indicatives, I think, is, if anything, more obvious when you go from the unembedded case to the embedded case, in particular to knowledge descriptions. And I think it's particularly so in connection with Steve's example. So, what I've been saying is Steve's kind of case is like this. Steve knows that Holmes doesn't exist. He also knows that if Holmes exists, he's not one of us. But I don't think that that second thing, that iffy knowledge Steve has about Holmes existing, requires it to be true that Steve knows Holmes might exist, or puts Steve in position to know that, you know, through some trivial piece of logic or something. It's just, ideally, we just want to be able to say 15 and 16, but not 17. And so I think it'll be easier to see how to get that if you reject what I was calling mighty indicatives. Okay, so so what's the fix to that? Let me say, this triviality too, I think, triviality one definitely makes iffy knowledge a kind of trivial thing, threatens to trivialize it, but so does triviality two, is my main point. We don't want either of these things if we want to like clear space for an interesting category of iffy knowledge, where the iffy knowledge you have isn't just trivialized by your knowledge that the antecedent is false, one way or the other. Okay, so I'm trying to make room for that sort of interesting iffy knowledge that comes up again and again in Steve's paper, and I think comes up in the puzzle cases I'm talking about as well. So what should we do? Well, I think I'm basically going to follow Ciardelli's lead. He's not talking about knowledge, but he's talking about the state of the conversation. But I'm going to apply some of his ideas to knowledge. So the idea would just be, you know, state of knowledge doesn't just fix a set of worlds, but something more structured like a set of worlds plus some ordering, you know, to get started very slowly. So we could say something like this. There's the elite best epistemic alternatives. I mean, often this kind of model is applied to belief, but I'm applying it to knowledge. So there's the elite best epistemic alternatives, and those settle your outright factual knowledge. And they, so, you know, when it's true that Steve knows that Holmes doesn't exist, that's a matter of what's the case at all of his best epistemic alternatives. All of them are ones where Holmes doesn't exist. Or if Holmes, if Steve knows that Shakespeare wrote Hamlet, those are all of his best epistemic alternatives are ones where Shakespeare wrote Hamlet. These elite epistemic alternatives also fix what you think might be the case. So if we know that Shakespeare might not have written Hamlet, then that must trace to, that in the model traces to the idea that among the elite best epistemic alternatives are possibilities like that. Okay, so we have this, the kind of elite epistemic alternatives, the best ones, are sort of doing what they always did for our fully factual knowledge and also for epistemic possibility knowledge. But the alternatives to the elite epistemic possibilities are not all on epistemic par. We have to allow that there are gradations. There are potentially more or less plausible epistemic alternatives to the best alternatives. So an epistemic state has to have a further structure for that. And then the thought would be, iffy knowledge descriptions can be sensitive to that and can be ways of expressing things about how things are with the agents less than elite epistemic alternatives. So here's an adjusted picture illustrating with 18. Steve knows that if Shakespeare wrote Hamlet, someone else... If Shakespeare didn't write Hamlet, someone else did. There should be didn't there. So the idea is 18 is true just in case when we update Steve's knowledge state with the information that Shakespeare didn't write Hamlet, which is to say when we restrict attention to the as it happens non-best epistemic alternatives where that is so. The best of those worlds, you know, considering the ordering restricted to that subset, are worlds where someone else did. So, you know, if phenologists potentially, where your antecedents cite possibilities that are not among your best epistemic alternatives, if phenology descriptions can characterize those less than best possibilities that your state leaves open, and you can use these if phenology descriptions to describe that the gradations that your state of mind make. Okay, so that's kind of the main idea I wanted to get at in this talk, that in thinking about if phenology description and trying to sort of make space for how it could be not trivial, it looks like we need to work with this. It looks like a reason to add this kind of structure to our thinking about epistemic states. So that gives us a picture of how non-trivial if phenology, that if P then Q is possible even when not P is known. I think there's still quite a lot to say about the epistemology of this iffy knowledge. It's not, again, this doesn't seem like it can be described as knowledge of truths. That's just not what it is. So there's more, there's a lot more to say. This kind of project will probably look like it has some real big affinities with Sarah Moss's probabilistic knowledge work, which is similarly directed at knowledge descriptions that embed things that don't look fully factual in a certain way. So here I'm focused on indicative conditionals and noting the way that their sort of non-factuality interacts with the most factual thing ever, which is nouns. Okay, but I think there's a lot more to say about this state. You know, once you have a model of it, maybe that helps us start to frame the epistemic questions a little more sharply. So on the semantic side of things, Vermilion, of course, still has a very serious problem with 16. Steve knows that if Holmes exists, he's not one of us. And, you know, it just traces back to the original problem I mentioned at the very beginning, the antecedent, if you're a million, looks either impossible or not a proposition expressing thing at all. And that threatens to trivialize the robust iffy knowledge that I've been trying to bring out and that Steve is pointing to in this paper and relying on. And so, as you know, Steve, of course, is very sensitive to that point. It's one of the kind of main themes of the paper, really. And he says, this is what he says after that quote about, you know, I'm tired of dodging this issue about the semantics of indicative conditionals. He says, well, look, you know, names have got to make a non-referential contribution in indicative conditionals, or else the Ramsey test is completely confused. As to say, you know, we've got to make sense of considering a state of mind, maybe even a state of knowledge, if what I've been saying is right, which involves temporarily updating it with Holmes exists, and any such kind of temporary update looks like, if Holmes is meaningful there, its contribution can't be understood referentially. If we can't make sense of that, so much the worse for the Ramsey test. Looks like it's just mandatory to explain that. And as Steve says, though, not a semantic contribution if Mill's right, it's a contribution nevertheless. Right, so it remains to work out the referential contribution. You know, I had hoped to talk about that too, but then I got to page 6 of this handout and I decided maybe I shouldn't do that, or I shouldn't try right now. Maybe I'll stop here. hopefully it helps to have seen, I guess, two things. So one is that there's this category, it's kind of like a category of possibilities, call them iffy possibilities, that not only are not metaphysically possible, but not epistemically possible either. So, you know, in other words, Steve's trafficking in possibilities, right? It might be right to say, you know, from the Millian point of view, you can wrap your mind around the idea that Holmes exists is impossible, or at least in some metaphysical sense. But nevertheless, Steve has this iffy knowledge about, framed with the antecedent, if Holmes exists. But, you know, that those possibilities are not even possibilities that Steve has to reckon might be the case, is my point. So the kind of possibility we're dealing with is, in a way, neither metaphysical nor epistemic. So that's kind of interesting and might complicate, or not, I don't know, I'd have to think about it. So the resources that have been marshaled to handle this kind of non-referential use, evocative use that Steve's talking about under epistemic modes, because we're kind of going beyond epistemic modes here. So that's one point. And then the other point is just, if you do want to say in some way that maybe if because your Millian scruples that Holmes doesn't exist, doesn't really express a proposition, is sort of, in a way, not a fully factual claim, then it maybe at least this preliminary work that I've done here at least helps us separate that element of non-propositionality from the non-propositionality of indicative conditionals in general, which I think comes out very strongly when you look at iffy knowledge. All right, I'm out of time, so I'll stop there. Thank you so much.